Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I have a treat for you today. It's not always the fashion makes the national news, or kind of makes the national news, perhaps not as fashion, but as its tremendous Trump defecating balloon. I don't know how else we describe it, that was at the last No King's Day march. And I loved watching the great Stephen Colbert lauding the balloon and its creators, although he didn't refer to the Backbone campaign or Bill Jarko, my guest today, directly. He said it was the most impressive thing about the whole march, which is pretty great. And coming from Stephen Colbert with his millions of followers. So, Bill, congratulations. Your work made national news.
Well, thank you. It certainly was amazing. And it's, I have to caveat, it's not just my work.
There was a big team
of people.
Yes, and that's what I love about Backbone. It's a team of creators, and then at the last moment, it was also a team of balloon managers.
Volunteers there.
That was extraordinary.
Yeah, we had to work to get them.
And so I want to remind listeners that I'm talking to Bill Jarko, and we're jumping right into the work on the Backbone campaign, but I'm going to tell you in a few minutes about his other extensive artistic background. But it's so it was so amazing to hear the story of you all with this team of creators, and just getting the darn thing to Washington must have been a feat.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, the guy who built, who sewed the thing was a guy named Rod Tharp, and he's down in Olympia. He's done a lot of Backbone campaign things. He's kind of this inventor genius, and he built a box that folds down like a transformer with wheels and then folds back up, and the whole thing just folds into it. And it weighs probably about 100 pounds, and we just, Bill Moyer just shipped it Alaska cargo, and we went and picked it up when we got there and fit perfectly into the van that we rented. And that was not a hard thing to do.
That wasn't the hard part.
Building the thing was the hard part, but actually shipping it was not.
I see. So it sounds like there were two hard parts. Then there was the building of it, and then there was the managing of it once it got inflated. So let's talk about the building of it. Whose concept was it? And how did you figure out what you were going to do and how to build it?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting story because it started about a year ago. And I kind of called this meeting together with Backbone folks and other people that I've worked with in the past.
Because you were, let me just say, you were one of the co-founders of Backbone.
Yes.
22 years ago, is that right?
23.
And you've stayed affiliated?
I've stayed affiliated during Bush, during Trump, I didn't stay affiliated during Obama. I didn't feel there was anything needing to be affiliated or Biden or anything. So
yeah.
It was just when things, in my opinion, got really disruptive and crazy. And, you know, now it's the craziest. But so a year ago, I was like, I got to do something, you know. And so I got a group of people together, like many that I knew and had worked with in the past, probably like we have about 15 or 20 people. And we started to have these meetings, and we came up with this idea of the March for America. And we were going to just create all these different things. And one of the things was at this particular meeting, after 5 or 6 meetings, and the group dwindled a little bit. And then we were at Mike McGrath's studio. Mike, he's the sculptor. And we were all talking about it. And Stephen Moody, was there, and he just stood up and said, "Why don't we have Trump with his pen?" And he's flaming out of the pen, flaming the Constitution on fire. And we were, I was like, "Yeah, that's great. Let's do that." And I had come up with the lice agents before that, and I was like, and then I said that I wanted to build those big heads, you know, the chain gang that we had for Bush and Cheney years ago. So I was very motivated to do make all this happen. So, I mean, I was the spearhead to get all this stuff done. And Stefan and I met and we did some drawings. And we were sitting in his little studio and we both kind of looked at each other and went, "I think the flame should be coming out of his ass." And we were both like at the same time, we're like, "Oh yeah, and people are going to be totally offended, but he's totally offensive and it's perfect." And so Stefan did a beautiful sketch of that. And then from that point, we got in touch with Rod Briggs, who lives on the island, who has worked on the other giant things, the orca and the salmon that Backbone has, and the globe, and Rod down in Olympia. And we talked about it. And it seemed like the project was dead because it was much more complicated to start with, because we were going to have somehow make this thing where Trump's is up and then his pants, he bends over, his pants fall down, then the flame comes out. And we went over that a million times and I was like, this is not going to work, you know? So then it kind of died. And then I started talking to those guys again and I said, how about if I make a simple sculpture? Stefan had made a sculpture which was really beautiful but complicated. Like, to make it into a balloon, it would have been very detailed. It would just not been possible. And then I talked to those guys and they were talking about something simpler, so I sculpted something. And then we found this young man named Kyle Gagne, and he is sort of this computer genius, and he scanned, 3D scanned this. And then he gave that to Rob Briggs, who mapped the whole, all the different sides of it, and then turned that into patterns. And then he blew those patterns up to fit the 13.5-foot tall Trump, gave those to Rod down in Olympia, and Rod sewed it with this woman, Laura, who works at the Backbone too, sewed it. And it just was like, this is really going to happen.
Amazing.
And then Rod devised the thing where the flame comes out and Patricia Tuvey made the flame. And we had a bunch of people. I painted myself and Tom Gross and Claire Dona painted the Constitution and painted Trump. And then it just started to come together. And then as we were approaching the Snow Kings, we were like, we're going to make this happen. We're going to bring the lice agents. Then all the two chain gang characters went to New York City and went to Seattle. And then, of course, the big Constitutions, which I have nothing to do with. Those were Stefan painted those.
Yeah.
We're all at five different places or four different places around the country. So it was a big, big push.
Yeah.
And it worked great.
Sounds like it was a year in the making?
It was almost a year. I think spring was the sort of start of all this brainstorming.
Wow.
And we made the heads over the summer, Claire, Dona, and Evan Simmons and I. And then we made the lice agents over the summer too, all in my little studio. And we sculpted. We got to sculpt at Mike McGrath's. He has this beautiful studio where we could make these huge heads and sculpt there. And that all just, you know, I was responsible for making this happen.
Oh, it's amazing.
Which has been really kind of a cool, you know, sort of our answer. Like, it was my answer. It was like, what can I do as a person? And this is what I do. I make mockery and weird, I'll say weird shit,
yeah,
and funny, you know, humorous stuff, mocking what they're doing.
What an amazing thing that your gift to be able to make humorous stuff,
yeah,
is became such a gift in the nation when it can be applied to political action. And of course, I love, you know, I talked to Bill last year, and my husband and I have been backbone supporters forever.
Oh, okay.
And because of this stuff, you know, it's like there's so many ways to contribute, and Backbone has a very needed and completely crazy, wonderful niche.
It really does. Yeah, it's been a fun ride being part of it, and then not being part of it, then being part of it, like plugging in. And this was the most ambitious thing.
Sweet. Yeah. Now, before we talk about your art background, there was the day of. And as I understand it, because with two of my guests, Ray Fortner and his wife Nancy Wing, they regularly go to the Macy's Day Parade. I think they're still called Macy's, and it may have been the last one.
Yeah.
But that's a whole, I mean, it's like a major operation managing the balloons.
Yeah,
because
those are enormous. Though.
They're enormous, and people can get hurt and all sorts of problems. Well, yours wasn't quite that scale, but then you think, oh my goodness, you know, you have wind and you don't want to, Trump is making enough damage in the world without having a Trump balloon going out across the Potomac.
That's very funny, yeah. I had this vision of maybe we should make one like 50 feet tall and get it in the Macy's Day Parade. Wouldn't that be
fantastic? It would be
fantastic. Right, yeah, I think they wouldn't let us.
I don't think they would, but are blimps still possible? Could you do a Trump blimp?
I have no idea.
That would be pretty cool, circling around.
Yeah, you know, you just gave me the thought of like, what would be really funny is get that on a one of those shipping boats that goes around the Puget Sound and travels all around. Put the Trump flame thing on that. That would be wild.
Oh, but sweet. But I would kind of like it back at the Potomac.
Yeah,
you know?
Back at the Potomac. That makes sense. Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, cool. I mean, I'm into this blimp thing because if you could just find one of those tech jillionaires who want to put money towards a good cause, it would be doable.
That
it would just
great.
Take one of those tech jillionaires.
It would take a tech jillionaire. It would definitely take a lot of money.
So how did you handle the balloon management on the day of? You found people on the street?
There was... First, before this bridge, I don't know what the park was. There's a park there, and that's where, like, people gathered.
Mm-hmm.
And we were part of... Bill knows all this stuff. Like, he knows the logistics of all these. That's not my thing. But my thing was to find people. And so there was crowds of people, and everyone was coming over and going, this is great, blah, blah. And I would be asking, who can help us? And most people were like, oh, no, I don't want to touch that. But four people helped on the Constitution. And then we had four other people to be lice agents. And as the story goes, and there was this young couple who had probably in their 20s who had never been to a protest. And they were like, yeah, we'd love to do that. So that was really fun. They were in these and they had a blast being in these costumes. And so we had a good enough team.
So you had costumes for the folks who were holding?
No, just for the lice agent
just
characters.
Just for the lice agents.
There's seven costumes we made.
Okay, cool.
And two were the people that came with us, Ellie Stahl and Andrea Walker. They got in those costumes. And then so we needed five others, and they were volunteers. Oh, no, Tom's daughter also came from St. Louis, and she was a lice. So we needed four other volunteers, which we got, and then four people to hold the Constitution besides the two guys in the back holding the main thing up. And then people helping to hold Trump's arms, especially as we came across the Potomac where it was incredibly windy.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was waiting. I was like, okay, is this thing going to make it, or are we just going to go fly over the Potomac, which would be kind of funny, but
it's
sad as hell after all this work. But it didn't, and we carried on. And
how far did you march?
We marched over the Potomac, that bridge, whatever that one's called, and then we stopped at the Lincoln Memorial,
mm-hmm.
where there were thousands of people because there's tourists and protesters, and then we marched down the Reflecting Pool, I think it's called, to the Washington Monument. And that's as far. Yeah, you know, I think it was probably a mile and a half, something like
that.
Wow,
a couple hours or?
Yeah, we were there for like 2 or 3 hours. It took the whole.
Yeah, but enough to get into the national news. Yes,
yeah.
Because those are the, I mean, I'm sure Bill is such a strategist. You probably are too. But to be able to say, okay, you know, like if we're picked up here, it's not just about being on the ground. That's important.
Yeah.
But we want it to go out.
Yes. And that's so important. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great to have the people around just cheering and laughing and saying, you know, you made my month, you made my week, thank you for doing this. But we knew that, you know, this was going to be photo. That's the point, was like, this is going to go viral around the world, which it did, which was really cool. As the day went on, Bill said, now we're up to 300,000 views on Facebook. We're just on Al Jazeera. We were in London Times or the Times, I don't know, whatever it is. I mean, we're just everywhere in the world. And that's kind of wild.
It's totally wild because, I mean... people like Heather Cox Richardson, who are writing every day about what's going on, they get a lot of views and they have a lot of followers, but they don't go viral like that.
Right.
You know, and there is something about art and performance art that has a special power. And I think Backbone really taps into it. Have you always been interested in performance art? Or did you back? Let me just stop. Actually, I'm interviewing today Bill Jarko, and we plunged into the conversation about the No Kings March and the incredible Trump balloon. But let me just give you a little bit about Bill's background, because he was a founding member of Backbone 23 years ago. And over his career in the arts, he's been an animation director, a creative director at Olive Jar Animation in Boston. He created shorts, station IDs, commercials, and videos for Nickelodeon, MTV, ABC, Saturday Morning TV, and Committee for Children, to name a few. He also directed episodes of Eddie Murphy's animated series, The PJs. And I could go on. His commercial and independent animated shorts have won numerous awards at animation festivals. And on occasion, Bill Jarko, have been seen as a WW1, a World War I flying ace riding a giant duck.
Yes.
So you had some performance art in you.
Yes. Yes.
Just on your own. How are you pulled into performance art? How does that relate to the creating of animation and goofy things in the world?
Well, I was I ran an animation studio in Boston for years out of college. And so I was doing all sorts of wild stuff for MTV and things like that, but it was animated. So it was, you know, painstakingly done on film and, you know, 35 millimeter film, old school stop motion animation. And I did that for like 10 years or something like that. And then I just kind of got sick of the advertising world and left Boston and traveled around the country and ended up serendipitously. Yes.
Are you really a spy?
Yeah. On Vashon Island, met all the Isle Wild people like Adam Ende and Stefan and Doug Scove and Hans Nelson, all these people I met at Bumbershoot one night 30 years ago. And they invited me out. They said, what do you do? I said, well, I'm getting into puppetry stuff and giant puppets. And they was like, oh, come on out. And then that was it. I didn't leave 30 years ago.
So how you were doing animation, but how did that lead to giant puppetry?
Well, I always wanted to, I was always interested in puppetry, but I never did it. And as I left town, I was like, I want to learn to do this art form. And so I ended up taking a workshop at the University of Connecticut on the way with a big puppet workshop, a lot of Henson people and stuff like that. And then I took some more courses around the country and stuff. And then I was like, oh, I want to do this work, but I don't really know how to do it or where to do it. And then I stumbled upon all these Isle Wild people who are making giant puppets and stuff.
Oh, that's amazing. Did you ever work with the Breton? Is it Breton?
No,
people?
I never did. And I was in Massachusetts for years and I never even went, you know, to the thing.
I spent a little time in Europe and experience the puppetry there, and it seemed like there was a lot of political puppetry.
Yeah.
But over here, I saw Bread and Puppet, and they did a form of political puppetry, I think, but I hadn't seen as much until I came here and saw the puppetry happening on Vashon.
Yeah, pretty wild, actually, that all the Umos and the Isle Wild folks and stuff like that. I kind of felt like, oh, I'm home.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, is puppetry something one does for a living, or is it
something? There are. Yeah, I mean, I had a business for 10 years, 12 years that called Zambini Brothers.
Uh-huh.
That I was doing giant puppets at festivals and fairs, and Stefan worked with me and some other people worked with me, and also was doing puppet shows at like King County libraries and things like that. So I was making my living along with doing some animation directing on the side for Committee for Children down in Seattle, and some cartooning and illustration work and all that. I was cobbling it together and teaching animation also at DigiPen out in Redmond.
Are you still doing animation?
No.
Uh-huh.
No, I stopped that probably six years ago. I did two short films, and that was kind of the end of it. Too much work.
Yeah, and I would assume it's a profession that changes really quickly with all the technology.
Yeah, I'm so out of, I'm like a Stone Age man, you know, like a caveman compared to what they do today, you know.
Well, at least you don't have to worry that AI is going to take your animation job, you know.
No, AI is not going to take my giant puppet Trump ass on fire job, that's for sure. I don't think so.
Yeah. So tell me about a day in the life of Bill Jargo. What do you do? How do you make your living? How do you, I understand that I saw on your website that you have some amazing children's books.
I've got two.
Yeah.
Not making a living off of those.
No, as a writer, I understand this fact.
Yeah.
But I was fascinated that you are married, but you don't have kids, but you have this whole childlike, you know, dedication to children through your puppetry and your books and your illustration.
Yeah, that's, I think that is my connection.
That's so wonderful.
No kids, but Susan and I got married late.
Yeah.
And neither of us had kids, and so we have dogs.
You have dogs.
Right.
Yeah.
Which are children-like.
And very lovely.
And no, I've just always been into that world with animation, cartoons, da-da-da, all that puppetry, all that stuff, and I continue that, and it's kind of fun because I get to be playful.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. It's like the child in you never had to go dormant.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's kind of cool, and to be able to still have that playfulness and do political stuff is really fun too. That it still has a sense of humor, although it's a little more biting, but it still has that flavor of cartoony kids feeling to it, but it has a little more sophistication because it's political. That's not a children's world necessarily.
Yes, but how great is that to be able to make people laugh and think at the same time? That's kind of what we need.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. I am grateful for being able to do this. So I'm retired. Like I retired like 5 or 6 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And sold my business, sold the puppet company to Doug Scove, who worked with me a lot.
Right.
And he's carrying it on. He's been performing all over the country in these giant puppet characters that we've created, like that duck that you were talking about. It was also a giant chicken that Cowboy rides. We're on stilts, actually, but it's kind of one of those where you have fake legs and it looks like someone's riding a giant chicken, a cowboy. So he's been doing that for 5 or 6 years.
Amazing.
And making a living off of it. I think he's doing pretty good. And I did okay, you know, doing that. It was fun.
Yeah.
I
love that. I mean, that one of the reasons I'm doing this show is that there are so many interesting ways that people figure out how to do a creative living on Vashon. I mean, who would have ever thought, you know, I'm making a living doing giant puppets.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That it's just like, oh, you can make a living making giant puppets.
Yeah.
Oh, never occurred
to me. Yeah. No, it's been fun to, you know, I look back and I'm like, oh, I'm going to be 68 next week. And I'm like, well, I've been doing this for 50 years almost. I've been being a creative person and making a living through either teaching, I taught all through the last 50 years off and on, animation. Taught a lot at the Blue Heron when I first got here, you know, a lot of kids' classes and things like that. And in the schools, and also, you know, different colleges around. When I was in Boston, I taught at two different colleges, and here taught at, you know, DigiPen Institute.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Did you and Stefan work together? Because didn't he, or
I got Stefan his job.
Yay,
at DigiPen.
Good job.
he actually was, I taught performance for animators, and then brought him in because they had a bunch of classes that needed extra people. So I brought Stefan in, who's perfect for that. And then he's been there for, I think, 12 years now, and he's an amazing illustrator and teacher. So he's in the illustration department. And so we've had a lot of connection there.
That's fantastic. Now, do you ever have younger people coming to you and asking, how can I live a creative life like you did, Bill? You know, because it would have been hard to predict. But what kind of suggestions would you have to somebody, your 20-year-old self, about how to do life and how to stay creative?
Oh boy, it was interesting. When my wife and I were in Belize a month ago, and we were just sitting at this beach where they were feeding the stingrays, which is a weird thing, and this one young man just started talking. He's like 20 something, started talking, and we started telling him. He asked me what I did and all that, and he was like, he's a creative person too. He's like, how do you do that? And I was like, I just did the things that I love doing. And I said, I know it sounds really cliche, but I just did the things that I have a, you know, an ability. Also, I have some kind of business sense that is an organizational sense that seems to work to be able to be a independent artist, because I know a lot of artists probably don't have that brain. Many do. And to those combinations of talent gave those combinations of, I'll call my abilities, gave me the ability to be able to do this, I think. You know, I've always just been very fiercely independent that way.
Yeah. And it also sounds like you were willing to patch a career.
Yeah.
Because I know with some artists, the ability to teach is really important, because
that's the steady paycheck.
And then you get to go for the ones that are inspiring, or occasionally maybe the big ones, but to know that at least your rent is going to be paid is always a good thing.
Yeah, no, that's important. And the animation world, I mean, it paid well when I was in the animation world. When I was working down in Portland on the PJs, that Eddie Murphy show, it paid really well. So that also supported me for a while, that I could come back and go, oh, I made this much money and I don't have to do that right now. And so, and I did, Committee for Children was fairly steady for 10 or 12 years. They would hire me to do all sorts of things. There was a guy there who became a friend. He would just hire me for cartooning and designing animation and building characters and doing some puppetry stuff. And it was a wonderful organization to work for. So there was always found this semi, you know, part-timey type of work combined with the teaching and then other things and the puppetry and animation.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. It's not predictable.
No.
Except maybe in retrospect, because in retrospect, you could probably see the through lines of what you were interested in, what you loved and what you followed and all. What was the biggest challenge
of that kind of life?
Yeah, that kind of life.
I think, when things are rolling, you still have to think about in 2 months when this ends, what is next? You know, what am I going to, how do I pursue this next thing? So that was a challenge, you know. You never sort of just could just settle in without sort of scheming.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so yeah, that's cool. By June, I'll need to line up a bunch of, King County Library gigs where they'll hire me to go to all these libraries around the area to perform a show that I've put together. So I have to put together the show. And, you know, so it was always that. And it was a challenge, but also kind of a good challenge, too, because it kept my mind thinking about, never sort of, what's the thing, sitting on your laurels? What is that?
Resting on your laurels.
Yeah. It never kept me resting on my laurels. You know, it was like, oh, I better do something else that can make some money.
Yeah, I had, I don't know, a 20-year stint or more as an independent consultant, and it was all like, holy crow, I seem to be surviving. Well, what's going to happen for the next? You know, like, I made it so far, but what about the future?
Right.
I think that was just a little scared part of me, because in the end, it all worked. But I never quite freed myself from that place of, doing fine, but what?
Right.
What could happen? Because there's no guarantee. Although, some of the people I knew who've signed up for the guarantee and worked for the government spinning these days.
Yeah, there's no, you kind of learn that, there's no guarantee. It doesn't matter, you know? I have a friend who works for the water and fish and wildlife in Snohomish County. And he's just like, I'm about to retire. I've been there for 35 years. And he said, I could never do what you do. I couldn't, even if I had that creative talent, I couldn't do that because I really needed that stability.
Yeah.
And he luckily has not been screwed that way.
Locally, but what a deal to have, because I contracted, taught leadership for people who had signed up for the 35 years in the same place, and you get a solid pension, and I couldn't possibly do that, but it was right for them. And then to come in and be completely, have everything messed up, or their jobs taken away, cheated out of the civil service system, it's like, that is so not what you signed up for. You never imagined that the lawbreakers would come in and rip away your system.
Right. There's no guarantees, right?
No guarantees.
So, either way, it's doesn't matter. It's sort of, just.
So are you 68 now? Is that the number?
I'll be 68 next, in a week.
I'm not aging you. I just heard you use the number.
In a week. I will be, yes, my birthday is next Friday.
So do you think ahead? Do you have any sense of how you want to stay personally animated for the next couple decades?
I'm continuing, I'm been very into like doing single panel cartoons and applying and trying to get into the New Yorker magazine.
Oh.
And I've been rejected three different times already. And I know it's a game of numbers. And so I've been very focused on that. And I also am part of Valise Gallery uptown, so I always have stuff in there. But those two things are interesting to me right now. I don't know where it will go.
Any more children's books?
I don't think so. I've had many ideas and old ones that I wanted to do, but it was like, that's a lot of work for not a lot of, it's incredibly satisfying to have a book in your hand that you've done. But it's a lot of work, and I kind of feel like right now I'm happy with the two that I did, and I might put a book of cartoons together, which is not for kids, but
sweet, that'd be great.
Yeah,
and because we're audio only here, I would be hard pressed to easily describe your art. Could you have a go at if somebody.
Sure.
Can go to BillJarko.com, I think, or your webpage and look at what you've created. But give me describe them so that we can give listeners a sense of what they're like.
I definitely tend to be in the cartoon world, bright colors and humor. Not all of it, but or surreal, abstract, but it still has that flavor of animation to it. You know, my stuff definitely has a quality of vibrancy and animated feeling to it. And it can be, you know, illustration or cartoons or sculptures or paintings. They all have this kind of, you know, similar look. Like my business partner, who's like my closest friend, one of my closest friends, lives in Singapore now. He's been there for 20 some years, and he was my animation. We founded that company together, and I sent him my book, my first book, and he said, "That's very Jarko." Like he could have picked it out of a million books. He would have, "Oh, that's Bill," you know. So we all, you know, artists have their style. You know, everyone has a look. Like you can go up the Valise Gallery and see my friend Greg Burnham, and you know that that's Greg Burnham's or Pascal's or Sharon Shaver's work. And so we all have a certain look, you know.
How fun. And do you get an inspiration for the thing that you, how does the concept for what you're going to create? Because it feels like there's a concept often, you know, there's a character or something that emerges in your work.
How does that happen?
Yeah, do you say, "I want to create a," and then you just go and do it? Or does it evolve as you're in the midst of creating something?
I think there's a number of ways. For instance, like the kids' books, I just will come, like some word or a name or a little rhyme will hit me, and then I can riff off of that. For the more abstract paintings or the sculptures, it will just happen. Or a lot of the times it's doodles. I'm a big doodler, and I doodle something, and all of a sudden I go, "Oh, that's cool," and then I'll expand on that.
Sweet.
In the case of the activist stuff, I mean, there's a definite direction. It's like, oh, ICE agents. Jesus Christ, I have to mock this somehow. Oh, lice. How perfect.
So perfect.
I mean, ugh, so perfect. Right? So perfect. Like it hit me. I was like, oh, that's perfect. And Trump, the thing with Trump and the fire butt, you know, it's like, oh, it's, you know, it's just perfect because it's directed at, like, there's a point to get to. And the point is how mockery, like something that authoritarians just hate. They just want to be revered. They don't want to be mocked. And, oh, we're going to mock them. How? What's the best way to do this, you know? So there's a definite, like, direction. And I do a lot of Trump cartoons just to blow off steam, you know? Like, after that Easter thing where he was with that big bunny, you know, in the White House. And there was this quote about him saying that this is the best Easter ever militarily, you know. And so I did a cartoon of all these little kids in the background, like in fear, and Trump with the big bunny, and the bunny's got a AR-15, and the bunny's looking like, oh my God, and Trump's going on about how this is the best Easter militarily.
Oh my God.
You know, I mean, he, you know, he just gives you the ammunition, you know, all the time, no pun intended, but so there's many different ways to get.
Have you tried any of his horrible cronies?
Oh yes.
I mean, the Stephen Miller one or the Pete Hegs.
Oh yeah, I did a great Stephen Miller one. I think that it was great, where it was I had him with a swastika on, and he was holding his finger up, and he was singing, "Now we're gonna party like it's 1939, Prince, and said Stephen Miller sings Prince, you know, like it's just like, oh, this is perfect. And I had I was part of a little show at Snapdragon about degenerate art, you know, it was pretty much anti Trump stuff. And when I sold a couple of those cartoons, and one guy came in, he goes, "This is amazing because I'm German, and my friend, I'm going to send this to my friend in Germany." Wow. About Stephen Miller. Is like, that's good. That's perfect. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, they're so evil that you can, I mean, it writes itself almost. They're so terrible. Every day is like, oh, more and more and more.
Oh, and I know. And then when they're going to church on Easter, proclaiming the values of killing the enemy to smithereens, and the priest is going, you got it completely wrong. And they're trying to argue. You're going, this is really insane.
What world is this?
What world is
Who
this?
Who are these people? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so some of that stuff just writes itself. And,
yeah,
you know, anyway, there's lots of different avenues that ideas come to me.
Well, thank you so much for your contribution, because the world, I mean, we need to take action, and we need to laugh, and we need to keep going. And we also need to see the absurdity. I mean, there's just something, I don't know, important about recognizing how effing absurd it is.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we can laugh. And at the same time, that the laughter doesn't keep us from acting.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great way to say it.
Cause it's really,
really important.
It's important.
Cause, you know, because I think what I noticed in the activist stuff recently is that it really, besides bringing, it brings people together and alleviates the fear, because everyone's buoyed by this great group of people, thousands of people around the country, right? Thousands of people around the country. No, millions. It was millions. Like
it
9
was
million
millions.
Or something
yeah,
like
9
that.
9 million, something
yeah,
like
but
that.
Yeah, but just in you know, in Washington, D.C., it's 10,000 or whatever. And people are laughing and having fun. And that raises the spirits up, the laughter and the fun and the joy, the music. And that gives people some power, you know, because they want us to be powerless.
Right, and the coming
and scared,
coming together and seeing your neighbors and seeing that you are connected, that to me, that's super powerful, because the actual actions we take, I think, are going to be varied. And
of course,
we don't everyone, all have the gift for giant puppetry.
Yeah, no, and everyone has, yeah, whatever you do. Like I have a cousin in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and she said, we had a huge turnout in Fayetteville. And Fayetteville's kind of a hip town because it's the university. But you go 5 miles around Arkansas and it's Trump land, the whole place. And she said it was amazing. Like, you know, just in our little town, we had, you know, thousands of people out just on the streets. And you go, yeah, that's pretty amazing, you know, and to have that many people completely saying no to this, you know.
Oh, so that's great news. I mean, because you do watch, even when the Arkansas start to
start to
turn even a little bit, you know that there's turning
happening.
Unfortunately, I love Vashon so much, but when I'm downtown protesting at the, you know, Center Village, you know, you go, it's a numbers thing. I want to be part of the numbers, but I'm not convincing anybody here.
No, you know, but I've heard that one before, and I say, you know, it doesn't matter where you are. It's just sort of, it's coming out, because I think that it's this built up energy, and it can be in Vashon Island, the bubble of the bubble within the bubble, or it can be Fayetteville, Arkansas, and it's the energy of the millions, you know. It doesn't really matter where you are, you know, so that, I think that's really important.
Yeah, I absolutely do too, and just on kind of on a closing note, that's why I am so delighted when art gets brought into the mix, because I feel like somehow art keeps us human, art keeps us whole, art lets us live in this gritty, interesting, creative dimension where the human spirit can live, as opposed to whatever manufactured reality is getting created out there.
Right.
So being able to keep art alive is already a resistance, and then using that art to actively resist is cherry on the cake. So yeah, thank you so much for all you've done.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That's fun.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.